My name is Charlie Penoff, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary purpose is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Nairi will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Nairi. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. DeVita will read the steps.
Hi, I'm DeVita. I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Robledo will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Robledo, and I'm an alcoholic. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is the desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supportive, declining outside contribution. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professionals. But our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service board or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholic Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn onto public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the levels of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personality.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Amy.
Hi, I'm Amy, and I'm an alcoholic. If you're new and you're scared, please don't leave. I remember coming to this room 3 years ago, scared to death, and thinking that I was not an alcoholic. I stayed. I kept coming to meetings, and I realized that I definitely was. When I was 16, I think I had my lowest bottom. And for almost 40 years, I continued drinking. So if that's not an alcoholic, I don't know what is. I was 16. I went to Woodstock with a bunch of friends, the first Woodstock. I'm younger than I look. And I proceeded to drink whatever was around, whatever came to me. And I also got raped. And proceeded for years after to continue drinking, continue telling people about Woodstock, how great it was, how cool it was, and not remembering what had happened. Again, if that doesn't make me an alcoholic, I don't know. I continued to drink like that, got myself into so much trouble through the years. I mean, you can all relate. I can't believe I'm alive today. I guess a lot of people may feel that way. I have to say that I am so grateful. I love AA. I can't believe that I can say that. It saved my life in so many ways. I actually was really a functioning alcoholic, and many people didn't even know I was. I hid it really well. I used to do all the kinds of things that we do. I would. I had a charge account to the local liquor store, and my husband would have parties a lot, and we would buy the alcohol, and we would buy, I guess, like once a month, we would do this, and in between, I would go to other local liquor stores to replace the vodka that was in the freezer and keep drinking till it was at that same level so my husband wouldn't know. All I can say is, if you're new, get a sponsor. I came here, I sat in this meeting, I don't think I heard a thing. Somehow I heard there was a beginner's meeting, and I still drank. I went to that. I went to that drunk. I was literally plastered on the wall. In that meeting, they ask you to give your name and say that you're an alcoholic. And when it came to me, I said, no, just pass. And I guess by the grace of God, Peggy said to me, and actually Stephanie did also, was my grand sponsor, do you have a desire to stop drinking? So I guess I did at the time, and I said yes. And I just kept coming. This amazing woman, Holly, kept calling me. If people are jumping to you and you're new and giving you phone numbers, take them. Call those people. When they call you, you may not want to hear from them, but just listen. Holly kept calling me, and it was the best thing that ever happened in my life. She became my sponsor. She's still my sponsor today. I'm so grateful to her. By the way, I want to thank Jen for asking me to speak. It's an amazing thing being here and standing up here. First of all, I never thought I could stand up in front of a group this large. Before I came in, I was scared to death of everything. And I thought that the alcohol was helping that. And now that I'm sober for 3 years, I realize that whatever I needed got filled up here in AA. And I have a higher power. And I guess that's what really filled me up. Having the friends here in this fellowship filled me up so much. It's an amazing thing. I don't know what else to say. I just want to say that I'm very grateful to be here. Thank you, Peggy, who started this meeting. I can tell you other things that happened to me before I came in. I see I have 5 minutes left to speak. I just did stuff. I mean, I did all the stuff that, you know, the alcohol led me to other things. I'll keep it into alcohol here, but I certainly did everything else. And I can't believe it today. I can't believe today that I am living a life where, you know, other people come first in my life. I have 3 sponsees today. I'm very grateful for that. I want to thank Evelyn and Liz and Mary Lou, who's not here today. And so I have a sober family, and they help me keep me sober. There's so much to do here also. There are all kinds of outings and fun things, softball. You know, don't be afraid to do any of that. What else can I say? I think I'm just going to leave it with that. I want to just thank everybody for being here, and I'm loving seeing all of the smiling faces that I know. So thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Gregory.
Hi, I'm Gregory, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, I'm really glad to be here. It's great. I got sober in San Francisco 6 years and 4 months ago, and I remember when I was new, I would sit in the audience, and people would talk about day and date and month and year, and I couldn't figure it out what that meant. I couldn't subtract or put it together to find out what their time is. So if you're new, for the next 10 minutes, there'll be no adding or subtracting. It's 6 years and 4 months. That's it. So what happened was I was late getting started, I guess, or I just got started when I got started. Prior to 28, I was just basically a normal drinker. I wasn't even a heavy drinker, just social. I didn't drink every day. I didn't even drink every week. And then what happened was I was in a relationship. And I just got I had everything pretty much done. I was buying my second executive home at the age of 24. I was in a very stable, steady relationship, dinner at 6 every night. Had a great career. I had trained as a nurse, but left that. I went into electronics and was an engineer and had all the material things that I needed. I had nice cars, I had a boat, and I got very bored. Just totally bored with everything. And I thought, is this it? You know, so at 28, I started drinking more and partying more. And things got a little bit crazy. And it was more on the weekends. I said to myself, this has got to change. So I decided to move to New Orleans. And my partner didn't want to go with me. So we broke up. And so I ended up in New Orleans and eventually ended up about 3 blocks away from this, in the French Quarter, about 3 blocks away from this bar called Pat O'Brien's, which was famous, they claim, for serving the most alcohol of any place in the world. And what was really great about New Orleans was that they allowed you to drink between the bars. You could have a little to-go cup and you could put your alcohol in there and just go one from one bar to the next. So what I did was I just got those same cups at my house, and I would just make my drinks and then go into the bar that way. Saved a lot of money, and saved money for all my friends. So, and that went on for about 8 more years. It got crazy. Life just got very monotonous. I got bored again. And I just remember thinking to myself, there was nothing left to do. And life wasn't going to change. It was the same thing. Get up, go to work, party on the weekends. I'd gone back to nursing. I was working 12-hour nights, so the only friends I had were night people. And the people that worked nights were either married with children because they were covering the babysitting thing, or they were partiers, and I was part of the party group. And it was just the same old thing over and over again. And I just remember thinking, you could hear the horses going by my Creole cottage on Dauphine Street, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, if I walked out into that street and just by accident got run over by a truck or a bus or something, that would be okay. Because it was just the same thing over and over again, and I didn't see things getting any better. But finally, I decided to do another geographic, and I ended up in San Francisco. And I thought, okay, here's where I'm going to pull myself together. But it was even wilder there. And what happened was, I used to always say they could call out the National Guard and try to stop all the parties that were happening in my neighborhood, and they'd never get them all. There was just parties going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I got caught up in that. But I still maintained my job. I wasn't losing anything materially, and so I didn't look to me like I was an alcoholic. I didn't look like I had a problem. And I didn't think alcohol was the problem anyways. I thought it was all the other illegal things that were going on. Those were the problems. It wasn't alcohol. But everything started with the drink for me. It always started with the drink. So what happened was I went to this group of professional men who were going to get their lives together. And we were led by a PhD who was a straight man who had dedicated his life to helping gay men get it together. So I joined this group because this was the only way I was going to do it. I wasn't going to come here. You know, this was the end. This was like a bunch of losers. So thank you. So I went to this group as behavioral modification. And we had to put rubber bands on. And if you felt like, you know, you popped the rubber band and, you know, you had to write things down and look at them if you felt, you know, like you were going to get crazy and all that. And after each meeting, I would just go and get a bottle of wine and drink. And after about 5 weeks, I was talking to this doctor, and he said, you know, Gregory, for a while, you may have to stop alcohol. And I was like, oh, no. You know, anything but that. But anyways, it didn't work. But I met a guy in that group who was going to AA. And I said, will you take me to a meeting? And he said, sure, I will. And you know what? That's what I needed, because I could never have made it to a meeting by myself. I had asked a guy like a year earlier if he'd take me, and he said, no, you have to find your own way. So if anybody ever asks you to take them to a meeting, my recommendation is please take them to the meeting. I was scared to death. I was too afraid to go in here. This guy took me into the meeting, and that was the beginning of it. I put the drink down a week later, and I haven't picked up since. And I just want to talk for a minute about that. Because in the big book, our basic text in the beginning, it says that if people who really try, 50% of them come in here and get sober and never relapse. And then there's another 25% that after some relapse can get sober and do get sober. So that's 75%. And back when I was in school, we studied, you know, alcohol, and that's what we saw too. You know, that was the thing back in the 70s. They said, oh yeah, Alcoholics Anonymous has this huge success rate. And I haven't always hear that. And I asked my partner, I said, well, how many people get sober? And he said, oh, 10%. And I said, but, you know, that's not what the big book says. And my little gang of people that I get sober with in San Francisco, that little gang, that little, you know, solar system that you start off with, they're all still sober. They're all still sober. Not that I don't know that people that went out, I know a couple people that died, but, you know, those people I got with, they're all still sober. So I never want to be up here telling you I'm the last man standing. You know, I never want that to happen. And so what I did was I chose people in recovery that absolutely believe in this program, absolutely believe in it. And those are the people that I chose to get close to. And so that I never have to be up here telling you I'm the last man standing, because I don't believe that. You know, I believe what the big book says. And so the other thing I'll just mention real quickly is I want to talk about practical recovery. And for me, what that means is when you have big catastrophes happen, I know what to do. Call my sponsor, call God, come to a meeting. You know, it's like all, it's real easy. But it's the little things that can drive me crazy. So I'm getting off the subway at 68th and Hunter, and there's a woman in front of me with a stroller. And it's crowded. And my first thought is, what is this woman doing here with a stroller in front of me? Doesn't she know any better? I mean, it's crowded. There's no elevator in sight. She's in my way. Then the conscious thought comes in. That's all unconscious. And the conscious thought comes in and it thinks, this woman has a right to be here. She's got a stroller. How can I get around her? And then God does for me what I can't do for myself. A man in front of her turns around and says, do you need help with the stroller to get up the stairs? And I go, woo, warning, adult behavior. I know it when I see it. And I'm looking at this guy, and he picks up the stroller, and he brings it up the stairs, and I get upstairs, and I think, wow, that's what it's all about. This is service. So here is where we learn how to do service, sponsees, taking a commitment. But then we get to practice it out there. And so I got it. What was the lesson in that? And when I'm up walking back home, I got a really conscious contact with my higher power, like a super conscious contact, and gratitude for that whole lesson. So the moral of the story is I'm not going to be running down the subway looking for strollers, but I mean, everywhere we go, there's opportunities to do service. If you're not sure how to do the service, that's okay. Come here. That's what we do here. We practice here. We learn how to do service here for each other. And then we can take it out there. And I just want to say to you guys, thanks, Duncan, for asking me to speak. Thanks, Bob, for being chair. And it's really been great coming from San Francisco and getting involved with it, with the Atlantic Group. You guys have been wonderful. And thanks for letting me share.
Our main speaker tonight is Jane.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jane Cecil, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. And there's no place in this world that I would rather be than here at an AA meeting with all of you. I love AA. It's my life. And February the 11th, 1970, I was crawling around the floor of our apartment with a bottle of warm vodka. I really preferred gin, but I don't know what happened. And I'd been doing that for 3 days and three nights. And I came to and I looked up, and my husband Bill was looking down at me. And he said, I can't live with you and I can't live without you. And he left. And I thought, God, I'm glad he's gone. Now I can drink the way I want to. Anyway, I knew I needed him. So I started compulsively, obsessively calling his office. And he wasn't there. He worked for Newsweek and wasn't like him not to be there. But what I didn't know was that Bill had gone to St. Bartholomew's Church and gotten down on his knees and said, I can't handle this anymore. And Bill was not a church-going person. So when he came back to the office and my call was waiting, he was very receptive. And I knew how to get him. I said, oh, Bill, I need help. And he said, do you mean it? And I thought, well, I got him back again. What I didn't know was that 3 months before, Bill had gone on a luncheon date because the man from Newsweek who should have gone was too drunk to make the date. And at that luncheon, Byard, a member of AA, uncharacteristically broke his anonymity to Bill. And thank God he did, because he was the only member of AA that Bill knew. So Bill called him, and he said his wife and a friend would come and call on me. So she called me, and she said, "Do you want company?" I thought, oh, God, I was in the alcoholic woman's robe with the stains and the burns. I felt like holy. Is that all right? Holy hell. But I knew I was on the spot, and I had to say yes. And she said, "We'll be there at 10 o'clock. So somehow I got dressed. Somehow I made a pot of coffee. And I thought, I'm going to give these do-gooders from AA this coffee in the living room. And I got a bottle of brandy, and I put that in the kitchen. For me, I thought that was the appropriate drink when you had AA in the living room and a brandy in the kitchen. And I thought, I'm going to get rid of them. I'm going to go one more time. This thing isn't going to get me down. I'm going to get it figured out. So we'll go back now to how this all started. For the lady from Nebraska, my story starts in Broken Bow, Nebraska, many years ago. My dad and my Uncle Mont bought the drugstore on the south side of the square, and we moved up from the little town, population of about 178, up to Broken Bow, population 3,000, the county seat of Custer County. I was 6 years old, and I walked into the new drugstore, and I never wanted to come out. It was so beautiful. It had a green marble soda fountain, a carved wood back bar with lots of mirrors, and I learned how to sell papers so I could spend time there. I learned how to make change, and cowboys would come in and put me on their shoulders and walk around, and I'd see myself in one of the many mirrors around the drugstore. I got this wonderful feeling that I found out years later was being the center of attention, which I was developing those alcoholic tendencies even then. When I was 13, I went to my first dance with Bob Evans. He sent me a gardenia, and he took me into the ballroom of the Arrow Hotel and put me along the sidelines. And went up, he was 13 too, went upstairs and got drunk with two friends. And the flower wilted, and my friends gathered around me and told me what a brute he was. And I became hysterical. And as a result, I never did learn how to dance. I was kind of more interested in the drama and the tragedy of relationships. When I graduated from high school, under my picture they put, "Maybe you can run this place without me, but I doubt it." So that summer, I was 17, I went to the western part of the state. I'd been building up to this at the Bow Theater. They changed their program 3 times a week. Fridays and Saturdays, they had the cowboy movies, and I never went to them. I was so frightened that I might be stuck in Broken Bow with a cowboy. I went to the movies where there were beautiful apartments and beautiful homes and gorgeous gowns and cigarette holders and stemmed glasses and, oh, Myrna Loy and William Powell, and they didn't seem to have to work at all. All they seemed to do was just solve a murder now and then, but it didn't seem like heavy lifting to me, and that appealed to me. So anyway, I went up to visit this girl in the western part of the state that I'd met at this Job's Daughters convention in Omaha, and it turned out she was rich. And they had a room in their house called the Rec Room, and it was furnished like I'd seen in the movies with chrome and glass. And I had spent the whole summer learning how to smoke in my Aunt Gwen's guest bedroom upstairs in front of a mirror, inhaling seductively and letting the smoke come out my nose and my mouth at the same time. So I was ready. When they asked me what I wanted to drink, I said, Tom Collins. And when it was finished, I thought, there isn't too much to this being an adult, is there? But I was filled with remorse, regret, and guilt. I knew I was doing something that my mother wouldn't approve of. So I went out and tried to buy her a big bottle of perfume. And that was something that went with me all the years I drank. I tried to buy my way out of those terrible feelings of remorse, regret, and guilt after an evening of drinking with very, very poor judgment. Like sending the florist's wife flowers and saying, so sorry about last night. Anyway, that fall I went to the University of Nebraska. They only served a light kind of beer. I could drink a lot of that. I could drink as much as great big boys. And that gave me a feeling of excellence I hadn't had up to that time. I didn't finish my first year at Nebraska. My mother committed suicide, and my father was very, very sick. So it was decided that we would go to Long Beach, California, where my sister lived. And when I got there, I joined a little theater group. I went to school. I got a job. I had to be very, very busy. I just had to have the next thing to do before I could hardly finish what I was doing so that I could keep going. And I was picked up the only time in a long career of drinking and driving in Long Beach at that time. I was going to a opening night party of the little theater I belonged to with my boyfriend. I was driving his car, and we were drinking beer, and the police stopped us. And I was driving his car, and he said, trade places with me, and I didn't. The police came, and they pulled him out, and they hit him a couple of times, and they took us down to the station. And as I went into the station with the policeman, I saw a sign that said, don't bring disgrace on your school, don't drink and drive. And I was studying acting, so I knew this was an opportunity for me, so I became hysterical. And the policeman said to me, what's the matter with you? And I said, for myself, I don't care, but I don't want to bring disgrace on my school. And he said, where do you go to school? And I said, Long Beach Junior College. And he said, oh, hell, I went to school there. You can't bring disgrace on me. The only time I was ever picked up. So anyway, my father died, and my sister had gone to Panama to be with her husband after the war, for Second World War was over. And so they asked me to come down and join them. And I went down, and the first weekend I was there, I had a blind date with Ensign Cecil. And during the war, everything, it seems, was rationed. We were rationed. We could have shoes or butter or cream or gowns to go to dances in. And so I was all gussied up, and I was really looking forward to this. And the houses in Panama were built on stilts and just had screening around. And so I was looking down this stairway for this guy. And when he started up the steps, he had on that white naval uniform. And he had brown curly hair. And he was smiling. And I took one look at him and decided I wouldn't drink that night. I was 20 years old. I hadn't been drunk that many times, but I knew then that if I picked up a drink, I could not predict what my behavior would be. I might be a lady, but I might be something else, and I didn't want to take any chances because he was so cute. And the party at Fort Amador was the first thing after the war was over, the first Army Day after the war was over. So the drinks were free at Fort Amador. And there was fear in the room. There was a rumor that they were going to run out of liquor. Well, I don't think there was any basis in historical fact for this. I don't think any Army bases ever run out of liquor, but there was fear. So people were lining the drinks up in front of them, six and seven deep. God forbid they might run out of liquor. And so it made for a wild night. And I didn't drink. It's hard for me to believe now that I didn't, but I didn't. And the next date was really wonderful. He took me to a beautiful rooftop restaurant, and the nights in Panama are really sensational. And he ordered me a martini. And he ordered the next one before I'd finished the one I was on, and he kept ordering. And I knew it was love. I knew that he cared for me deeply, that he understood me profoundly. And we both smoked Chesterfield cigarettes and drank our coffee black. And on that firm foundation, we were married 2 months later. Yeah, people said it wouldn't last, but when Bill died, we'd been married 34 years, so there. Anyway, we came back to the United States. His family lived in a pretty house in Scarsdale. And when his mother opened the door, she said, "You poor little thing, you look scared to death. Come on in and have a drink." I thought, oh, my Myrna Loy. I have walked right through the movie screen. And then it turned out that the last girl that had come to visit them was named Jan. And she wasn't one bit funny or fun. Because you know what? Jan didn't drink. Oh, I was so thrilled. I was doing this thing that I love to do, and I was getting credit for it. Oh, anyway, we had 2 sons. We moved 17 times. Won't take you every place we moved. But by the time we got to Cleveland, no, the time we got to Cincinnati, I was becoming loud and vulgar at luncheons and dinner parties and, worst of all, things that involved Bill's business. And one night in Cincinnati, I stood at a dinner party for 200 people and told them in obscene terms what I thought of their values. Now, I can remember the look on the faces of people I knew and people I didn't know, all looking horrified at me as my husband pulled me from the hall. And the next morning when I came to, I thought, oh, my goodness. Should do something. So instead of doing anything about my drunkenness or my obscenities, I chose to join the Henry Miller Society so that obscenities would be accepted by the population at large, and I wouldn't have to change. That was very important, that I not have to change. By the time we got to Westport, I went through a period of running through the woods naked on the weekends. But that only lasted for a year. And then when we got to Norwalk, I read The Days of Wine and Roses. And it really got me. And I thought, you've really got to do something. And then a voice in my ear said, "Jane, if you ever destroyed a greenhouse, then you'd know you had a problem. Otherwise, everything's all right." My sister moved from Long Beach, California to Longmeadow, Massachusetts, and she invited us to all her parties. I would drive with my children drunk in the car, and I'd put my foot on the accelerator, and I'd press it to the floor, and I'd say, "Whatever happens, happens." And you know what? I don't give up. I didn't give up about my children or my husband. I didn't give up about me. But often when I'd get to my sister's, she'd open the door and she'd have a pitcher of martinis just for me. And there was something akin to love around my heart when I saw that gin. Well, the topic of conversation this night at cocktails was the man who had built the awful house in their neighborhood. It was a modern monstrosity. It was going to lower their property values, and they took that very seriously. And they became very graphic about what they'd like to do to him. They tar and feather him and roll him out of town on a rail. And so I took that all in, and about 4:30 the next morning, I got to thinking about my taste in architecture and art, and I came to the conclusion that I loved this house. Well, as soon as this thought hit me, I knew I had to share it with the man who must feel the animosity of his neighbors. And so in my nightie, with no robe or slippers, I ran across the road through the snow, down the lane to ring his doorbell to tell him he had a friend in me. I loved his house. Well, he never came to the door, but 2 men in a police car came and took me back to my sister's. And I went quickly to my room, and the next morning when I came to, I was so sick. In every way we alcoholics are sick, I was so sick. I wanted to say to my family, I don't want to humiliate you. I don't want to humiliate me. I don't know what I'm doing. But I'd given that up in Cincinnati, and so I sat in front of the mirror going through my toughening up act, saying, I don't give a good goddamn what you think. I'm going to drink the way I want to. And I had to go through that several times before I could go out and face them. And when I went out to face them, they were talking about sending me away. So I knew I had to give up what I'd rehearsed, say something very simple and to the point. And I said, I will never drink again. And they said, fine. And I didn't. And I didn't drink for 9 months. And at the end of 9 months, Bill had a business trip to San Francisco, and he invited me along. He said I was a bit difficult to live with during that 9 months, but he did invite me along. My sister had moved back to Southern California, and we arranged a family reunion that Sunday. We went to Sausalito for brunch, and it was a beautiful day in San Francisco, blue and white and beautiful, and I felt good. And we had a big round table overlooking the bay, and all the members of my family that had gone through the ugliness of my active alcoholism were seated around the table. And the waiter came up to my brother-in-law, and he said, what do you have? And my brother-in-law said, a Ramos gin fizz all the way around. And I thought he was going to say, except for her. But he didn't. And I thought, I think I'm supposed to say something. And then a little voice in my ear said, Jane, a Ramos gin fizz isn't a real drink. And that made sense. It wasn't a real drink. A martini was a real drink. And so I had it, and I didn't even finish it. Didn't have anything next day. Didn't have anything until Wednesday. I had a little glass of wine with lunch, and I didn't even finish it. And I thought, oh, my God, 9 months. It's a very special block of time. I bet there isn't a cell in my body that is the same as when I was having all that trouble with alcohol. There's been a miracle in my life, and I'm what you call a social drinker. And I thought about it morning, noon, and night. Wonderful social drinker I had become. And 3 months later, I was there on the floor. And they were coming. And they were coming at 10 o'clock. And as I said, I had gotten myself dressed. And at 10 o'clock, the doorbell rang. And I opened the door. And the lady looked me in the eye. And she said, do you want to stop drinking more than anything else in the world? And I said, yes. And I was so surprised I said it. But I was more surprised how deeply I meant it. I wanted it more than anything in the world. And I had wanted it for a very long time. I just didn't know how to go about it. She said, then we'll help you. And these beautiful ladies came in and sat in my living room and drank my coffee and told me stories of things they had done when they were drinking that I had done that I swore to God I would never tell anyone. And the isolation started breaking down that day. And it's been breaking down every day since. It's been a wonderful, wonderful journey. I was 4 months sober, and I had this opportunity to get my first professional job in the theater. And guess what? I was to go down to Pennsylvania and do Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? My sponsor said, don't go. And I said, no, no, you don't understand. This is my big opportunity. So when I got down to this little place in Pennsylvania, I called my AA number, and she was drunk. I went to the Episcopal priest, and he said, don't tell anybody in this community that you're an alcoholic. So I didn't sleep much during the run of that show. Oh, but one thing I did. In rehearsal, the director said, Now put the drink down when you go and show Sonny the bedroom. And I said, no, she wouldn't put the drink down. And he said, boy, you've really done your research. So it's been wonderful, beyond my wildest dreams. I even was on Broadway twice, if you can believe that. And the most wonderful thing happened. I was in House of Blue Leaves with Jerry Zaks as the director. And I would have done anything that he told me to do. And there was beer involved. And they found a warehouse full of beer down in Pennsylvania someplace so that it would be authentic. And they brought the beer up. And for that rehearsal, he said, Now, just crack and take a big gulp. And I said, I can't. And he said, what do you mean you can't? Could you just not swallow it? And I thought, well, then I wouldn't be able to say anything after that, but I didn't say that. So I thought, well, I've lost this job, but the most wonderful feeling came over me because I knew then that AA was the most important thing in my life. I hadn't really been tested in any way up to that point. And so I went home, and I called my friend Tad Moselle, who was in the program, and I said, well, I've lost the job. He said, what happened? And he said, tomorrow at rehearsal, just shake up the beer and then open it. So I did, and I opened the beer, and it went all over the audience and all over the stage, and the director said, that's terrific. That's wonderful. And the other nun had to drink the beer, and she said it was really foul. So I've really been cared for. I got to be in a Woody Allen movie, which I was just... And I got to be on Law and Order, which was beyond... Everything has been beyond my wildest dreams. And I have 5 wonderful grandchildren and 2 great-granddaughters and a grandson expected in August. So my... Oh, and when Bill was in the hospital, he was dying, and... And the doctor said... He took me out in the hall the day before he died, and he said, there isn't anything I can do for Bill, but I want to do something for you. I want to give you some Valium. And I looked at this dear man who loved us both, and I thought, that's the best he's got to offer. I got rooms full of people who are uniquely qualified to help me through anything that happens in life. And on the same thing, I'm uniquely qualified to help them. So I think we're the luckiest people in the world. I can't imagine a more wonderful way to go through life than in AA, to be able to be of service each day and to receive help. I love you all, and thank you for my sobriety.